the message came across. And so the question or the comments are near white answers. In particular, we talked about different kinds of cancers, or I had a general rule, but the two most important ones that we're going to be running into are vectors and covectors, contravariant, covariant, or vectors in one form, and there were these transformation rules for those. And I said it was very important. These were, in some sense, the defining characteristics of cancers, that they transform in this way. And then I told you, but he never used that rule. And so just remember it's in the book there somewhere. And then I started talking about, well, some objects are cancers, some objects aren't cancers, but they all look like things with indices on them, so what's the big deal? I can't turn. Oh, can I turn the link? That's three.
All those words of wisdom lost.
No. Okay, so why cancers? What's the big deal? And it comes down to this idea that's been implicit in physics or in our discussion of geometry, that geometry or physics should be independent. Coordinates. And so coordinates are just convenient labels for points in our geometry or events in our space-time. And so if I have a sphere, you know, typically we use lines of longitude and latitude, but if I throw down some screwy coordinate chart where the axes or surfaces of constant whatever coordinates run in some funny way, I'm just putting a new set of labels there. The surface didn't change, the geometry didn't change. However, coordinates are very important because, as physicists, at the end of the day, what we have to do is we have to calculate. And what do we calculate? Well, we calculate numbers. And that's an important thing to remember, because when an experimentalist does an experiment and he writes the answer down in his logbook, what he's writing down is a number. He's not writing down a directed line segment or a vector or a matrix. He's writing down a number. And so what we want is we want a framework where everybody agrees on what those numbers are. So rather than talking more about vectors, what I wanted to do is talk about an example of something that isn't a vector to emphasize this point. And so one of the objects that we almost ran into, or there was some discussion of, is if I'm given a world line in my space-time, well, we're given a parameterized path. So there's some x alpha of tau. From that, we calculate the four velocity, or we might calculate the four velocity. And we were also talking about, well, what if it's not a geodesic, or then the particle should be accelerating, or there should be forces applied. We might also calculate this second derivative, d2x, d tau squared. And that's something that we calculate in special relativity, and we call it the four acceleration. But I said that that wasn't a tensor, or it wasn't a vector, and so it's not going to be something that we use in general relativity. And so when I say it's not a tensor, I mean it doesn't obey this rule, even though, you know, if I do the calculation, I come up with a collection of four numbers that are four numbers that live all along the world line. It looks like it might be a vector. We might give it a name. But the point is that this v doesn't satisfy this rule up here. If I change the coordinate systems, it doesn't satisfy that rule. And I'll invite you to figure out what rule or how it does actually transform. I'm not going to go through those details. But the point is that if I want to, or how it might come into a calculation, how I might produce a number is, for example, I might calculate, say, the inner product of the four velocity or somebody else's four velocity. We can put a prime there, dotted into V. So it might be the four velocity of some observer who's passing this world line. And I would get a number or a collection of numbers. And if I did, well, implicitly I could do that calculation in x coordinates. And I could do the same calculation in y coordinates. But the point is that even though it looks like a vector, that looks like a scalar or an invariant object, when I do the calculation, because this didn't have the right transformation rule, these two functions or these two collections of numbers that I calculate are not the same. And so the point is then that this isn't a useful collection of objects, or it isn't a useful object to characterize that world line. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'll try and remember that. I apologize. So that's the whole point of why describing everything in terms of tensors is going to be important, because if we use these objects or some collection of objects that aren't tensors, then when we do the calculations in different coordinate systems, or if I assign you a problem and you happen to choose different coordinates to do the problem in, you end up with different answers. And so what tensors does for us is it gives us a framework where we know how everything transforms. And the point of that is that then when we calculate our numbers, everybody agrees on those numbers. And it doesn't matter how they set up the problem to do the calculation. So since I ran over at a room over there, I'll just say over here. And so I'll remind you that we had this other object instead that I called the four acceleration, where we supplemented that by an extra bit. So this is a four vector, and so I can make statements like the inner product of the four velocity with the four acceleration is equal to zero. And everybody's going to agree, or everybody who does the calculation properly is going to agree on that result, or this number, irrespective of how they set the problem up or what choice of coordinates they make when they're doing the calculations. And so again, the importance of tensors is having a set of rules like this, is that it's giving us a framework where we can do the calculations and everybody agrees when we get down to the final numbers. And it's also, though, the simplicity of these invariants or the fact that these don't change between coordinate systems, which is why I was suggesting that when you actually want to transform, say, a one-form, don't go to that rule, but rather build a simple invariant and then do the transformation there. So, the example for the one form that we talked about, or that we did in class, was it's much simpler to see, to work with this object, and you just end up using chain rule in going from one coordinate system to the other, rather than this equation over here, which I might call so again, that's just a reminder, but I wanted, well, to say it, it may have been under the radar or implicit in the discussion before, and so I just wanted to make sure that everybody got the message. Are there any questions about, two questions, we'll start with you.
Like, it's the only time you ever deal with numbers is if you're trying to expand it in terms of a basis. And so the vector should, you know, if you're looking at some invariant, a vector is just a vector no matter what frame you're in.
Yeah.
And so how if that V there you're calling a vector, yet it's not transforming correctly, then is it really a vector? And could you maybe talk about the distinction between basis, like between vectors and components and basis things? Because that's sort of, I think, not been clear throughout a lot of this.
So again, let me emphasize, though, that if we were doing mathematics, then the discussion you're putting forward is, you know, there's a beautiful story about differential geometry that we don't have time to get into. And again, what I wanted to emphasize, though, is that as physicists, what we have to do is calculations, not just, you know, well, you know, at the end of the day, we want to compare various theories with experiments or predictions with experiments, and what that amounts to is comparing different numbers and seeing if they agree. And so at the end of the day, in your problems, what I'm asking you for is what's the frequency or what's, you know, the time or something like that. And so at the end of the day, we need to go to a coordinate system and do a real calculation. That's why I'm sort of stressing it this way. Well, again, maybe we can talk about it later if you want in the break, but there is, you know, there is another, well, there is a more expanded story of differential geometry, and we don't ever, or you don't. In principle, one doesn't have to refer to bases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, that's a very abstract setting. It doesn't match well with the idea that at the end of the day, I have to do a calculation.
So just in talking about the thing where people wouldn't necessarily agree on u dot a, where a is not a vector. So what I'm wondering is, so when people are doing those measurements, is it kind of the assumption that maybe you don't actually know what coordinate system you're in or something? Because, like, what I'm wondering is, could two people do the calculation but know their relative coordinate systems and then, like, do this other transformation to make sure they got the right answers? Or is that just...
it's certainly true that, you know, there is a, you know, this is an object I defined. I didn't tell you, all I said is it doesn't transform this way. There is going to be a rule that says
how I can transform from one coordinate system to another. And so if we really insisted that, you know, I want to know what that vector is or what that object is, in a different coordinate system, or if I wanted to compare those two vectors, I could do that, but.
So is the idea that like maybe you can't construct like those scalar invariants out of these non-four vector things? Because like scalar invariants are really good because.
Well, that's what I was saying here, yeah, that's, well, that, yeah, that's the whole point.
So you can't really do it with these guys?
Okay. Yeah, that's, well, that's what, you know, this looks like an invariant, this looks like it should be the same thing, but the point is that they're not, because this isn't a, so you'd have to have, yeah, a more complicated equation there, so that you'd end up with something that is equal in those terms, that's all.
So is the term in your, in the force acceleration, isn't the term on the right, like, self-signals kind of what's telling you how it transforms in different frames?
Sorry, is that again? What equation?
The definition of force acceleration.
Oh, this. Yeah. What?
Is that term on the right what's telling you how it transforms, basically what's telling you how it transforms in different frames?
Well, there's nothing that's telling me that how this transformed is by I'm not sure. So let me answer like this. I mean, I'd have to do an explicit calculation first of all to see that this isn't a vector or it doesn't transform by that rule. There's another calculation I do to see that this has extra stuff as well. And but then you might notice that by putting them together in this way, that extra stuff cancels out. Alternatively, you know, this object, I mean, the way this object for that collection, this thing was derived is it was derived by the variation of an action. And if you think about what you have there is you know, you have the action, which is an invariant or a scalar quantity. You're making a small variation, infinitesimal variation. Delta x is also a four vector, and so the delta l must have been, or the delta, you know, the variation, the four vector that it ended up being contracted with must have been a four vector. So that may have been a hint or an indication that this combination of things was a four vector. But at the end of the day, you know, the way to verify it is just to do a coordinate transformation to see that everything canceled. Are we happy with that? Okay, well, what I wanted to do was move on. And the next topic is the Schwarzschild metric or the Schwarzschild geometry. So that's.
Represented by that line element there. And I should say what it is. Well, this is a solution of Einstein's equations. So I'll put that in quote because I haven't told you what those equations are yet or how you solve them. But this solution describes the geometry or the space-time outside of a spherical mass or a spherical star. So in some sense, this is the Coulomb solution of Einstein's equations, or it is what the Coulomb solution is to Maxwell's equations. this is to Einstein's equations. And it's basically the one of the simplest solutions of these equations. Einstein wrote down or published his theory for the first time in late 1915, and this solution was written down or derived by one Carl Schwarzschild, hence the name, just a few months later in the first half of 1916. And to a good approach, well, it's a very idealistic geometry. It's describing empty space outside of a perfectly spherical mass distribution or energy distribution. To a very good approximation, this is going to describe the space-time outside of an object like a star or the sun or the Earth. And just to be very explicit, again, line elements are nice invariant things. And so that's the standard way to write it down. But I'll remind you, there's a real metric here, which means it's a 4x4 matrix or collection of things. And I've written it down as a metric there. And that's the last time, probably, that I will ever write down a metric. But I just wanted to make sure that object is hidden here. But again, the invariant object is a much simpler thing to work with. And so that's why, even though we say the Schwarzschild metric, say what people write down is the line element that collects it up in a very nice way. So the first thing then that we're going to do is just sit back and look at this beautiful geometry and observe some of its properties. So the first property is that the geometry is static. None of the elements here depend on time. So everything's invariant in time, as would be appropriate for an object or a star that's just sitting there, a static star. So T, given our discussion last day, what we say is that T is a killing coordinate, or there's a killing vector associated with it, which in the book gets, I'm not sure if it's a C, I have in my notes is an epsilon, and epsilon alpha is just delta alpha T. Or the 4 vector is just a 1, 0, 0. And again, the importance of that is going to be, well, we're going to explore this geometry in a little bit by probing it with particles or photons or geodesics. And this is going to give us a conserved quantity. We have that. So when I look at a geodesic passing through this space-time, then the inner product of that killing vector or this time-like killing vector with 4 velocity equal to constant. In the same vein, Another observation here is that this is independent of phi. And so, likewise, there's a killing vector or so there's a killing vector that just has a phi component over there. In fact, there's more that you can say. This says that there's a particular symmetry having to do with rotations around the phi coordinate direction. On the other hand, if we fix time and we fix r and we just move in the theta and phi directions, then the line element or the geometry is just described by this little piece of the metric. Motions, well, if I, for a surface of fixed T and R, if I'm thinking about motions in theta and phi, the distances or the geometry is described just by that part of the metric. But we recognize that part of the metric as the part of the metric that arises in spherical polar coordinates. Or alternatively, you might recognize this as the metric on a round sphere of two dimensions. And so this is actually then part of a bigger set of symmetries. We can say that this whole space-time here is actually spherically symmetric. And so it should be symmetric under a whole set of three independent sets of rotations around three different axes. So this is so the geometry that's the comment I was about to make, yes. And in fact, the next comment is that in principle, you have an equation that would let you find those extra vectors. But we're not going to be bothered. We're just going to take this simple one that's obvious, and we'll be able to work with that. So actually, we'd have, no, I'll just write it that way then. We'd have symmetries under a basis of three independent killing vectors. And this, so in flat space, those are the rotations about the three Cartesian coordinate axes. That would be an interesting basis. But the point is that we just have one, is one of these. The other thing, or the next thing one might observe, is that if I go off to infinity in the r direction, well, these two terms are growing, but the 1 over r's here are dying off. And so out at asymptotic infinity, the metric just reduces to a minus c squared 1, and then those terms, or this piece here. And so basically, out at asymptotic infinity, I've recovered Minkowski space in spherical polars. And so we would say, which is our flat space time. And so what we would say is that the Schwarzschild geometry is asymptotically flat. So that was 1, 2, 3. So by definition, Minkowski space is the geometry without curvature. And so we say that Schwarzschild is asymptotically flat. Another interesting approximation to take is to think about a non-relativistic limit, or a limit to think about making an expansion in 1 over c squared. And so what we find then is that I can write, well, the first term is very large. So there's a minus c squared. I think I want to keep that. Minus c squared dt squared. There's, if I multiply the c squared, or I cancel the c squared, there's a term left over that's order 1 in this expansion. So I'm expanding in 1 over c squared for large c, which I can think of as a non-relativistic limit. So there was the c squared term, and then there was a term that here that I'll write 2 minus gm over r. So this is just writing that second term. If I look at this term is approximately 1 plus stuff that goes like 1 over c squared. And so I'll drop the things that are going like 1 over c squared. And that's why this is approximately. And there are no c squareds here, so that part just comes along for the ride. Now, this bit is something, again, that I recognize as flat space in polar coordinates. So I could write that as, in Cartesian coordinates, as just a sum over dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. If we look at the metric, then, that metric might be familiar from several lectures ago when we were talking about weak gravitational fields and slow velocities. What we wrote was a metric that had exactly this form, but what appeared here is phi, the gravitational potential. And so this is precisely the gravitational potential that you calculate in Newtonian gravity for a point-like mass, or for a spherical mass of mass m. So we recover the what is it? Non-relative. Well. So before we had this discussion where phi over c squared was small, v over c squared was, v squared over c squared was small, and we ended up with a metric. And so we see that we're precisely recovering that for a spherical mass m. But I stress that, before, when I'm just writing this down, I'm just writing as it's given, I'm just writing suggestive labels in these different places. But what we see from this discussion, which is really physics, is that label that I called M really is the mass of the object that's generating this space-time. The other thing that we might note is that in Newtonian gravity, it was an interesting result that this, that the gravitational potential just had this 1 over r form outside of the mass distribution. For example, if I had a Newtonian star, the mass density would have some distribution in the middle, and the potential had some interesting form. But as long as I had spherical symmetry, as soon as I got outside of the star, so where there's no more matter, the potential just had this 1 over r form. And so again, we're seeing essentially the same thing here arising, that here I'm imagining that this is the space-time geometry outside of the star, and it only depends on this combination gm over r. It doesn't matter what the details of the distribution of the matter or the mass inside the star is going to be. And the last comment then, if I look at this, something interesting happens at r equals 0, by which I mean if I look at GTT, what I see is it diverges or explodes at r equals 0. Similarly, if I look at GRR, it's actually going to 0 at r equals 0. However, there's also something interesting happening at r equals 2gm over c squared, because at that point, this actually goes to 0. And then change, if I go to smaller radii, it changes sign. Similarly, this one diverges at that point. And if I try to go to smaller values of r, I'm actually trading or changing the sign of GRR. And so at this point, we're just going to make a note of it, that these are interesting places in the geometry. And we'll return to this later. However, I'll add the comment that if I'm talking about a star, then it turns out that the size of the star is always larger than this distance here. And so we don't have to worry about these details, for example, if we're talking about the space-time around the sun. Yeah.
When you expand your ds squared, especially with 1 over c squared, you can choose units of c so that c is large, c is small, and so on. How do you know that this is allowed?
I don't. I'm cheating. What you're saying is that this is dimensionful, and so it's not a valid expansion. What I should have said is that I'm expanding in some small dimensionless number. And so the small dimensionless number that I'm actually expanding the metric in, only keeping leading terms, is that combination. I'm saying is small. That was the sake of the phi over c squared was small. And then implicitly, I'm also, I'm thinking about situations where v squared over c squared is small, and so there's this discussion in the non-relativistic case that, I mean, there is a term linear in gm over r over c squared here, but that would be a higher order correction in the physics because it would combine v squared with phi, or it would combine it. So I was being lazy and cheating there.
There's another question from Aaron.
Radar is negligible in, like, why do we disregard it in the second term, but regard it in the first term, other than the fact that we need to recover the metric that
So that was the discussion that I didn't have, which is that when we talked about
physics here, what we were talking about was physics not just with a weak gravitational field. We were talking about physics where the velocity was small, or the velocity of anything of interest was, or observers or clocks was small. And so it's not a parameter that naturally appears here, but for example, if I divided everything and made it proportional to dt squared, what I would have seen here is dr over dt squared, or d theta r squared. So this extra term that you want to keep would have been, or you can see that relative to these terms here, this would be a term that's v squared over c squared times phi over c squared. And so it's second order in the double expansion that I'm talking about.
From the perspective of some of the velocity relative to the star, the metric change?
If I was thinking about someone who's moving close to the speed of light, that metric isn't sufficient.
Right, so like, I'm not sure I understand, like there's no velocity to expand in. If we're looking from a perspective in which the star is stationary, this is just the metric.
Right, so let me try again. Let me choose to write this as dt squared times
stuff. Then I have minus c squared plus 2, I'll write it as phi. And then all of those contributions I can write as dr squared over dt squared plus, or maybe I'm missing the point that you're trying to make.
Metric that looks like that, with like a phi. And so you want to say, you're like, oh look, it looks like we can recover the Newtonian gravity from this vertical metric, which you should be able to, because it should be, you know, Newtonian gravity is the weak field approximation of the short slope metric. But when we take the weak field approximation, when we take gm over r much greater than c, or much smaller than c squared, it seems like both like Newtonian gravity and relativity disappear.
Yeah, okay, so once again, I was lazy in writing this down. I'm cheating you. The thing that we want to compare to is a situation where phi over c squared is small. That's something that's obvious. We can look at the metric, and there's our phi, and it comes with 1 over c squared. It's just a number. And so that's small, and so it's obvious how to do that. What I'm doing, though, is I rewrote the metric here. I rewrote the same thing. All I did is I pulled out this factor of c squared and dt squared. And so I'm going to compare everything relative to this first term, which is a minus 1. And so there's a correction that goes like pi over c squared. So that's small, but it's of an order that I want to keep. If it was pi squared, or pi over c squared squared, I would throw it away. Yes?
Okay.
I've only gotten this far. But now what I did is I pulled out this c squared dt squared, and the rest of this stuff now becomes stuff like 1 over c squared times something that looks like a radial velocity squared. And so what I'm saying is, if I'm studying a physical situation where my observer or my particle is moving slowly, then this combination is much less than this. Because I want, or what we talked about before was both of these things small. The term you would have kept is a term, or the term that is obviously there as well, is this one, which would have a 2 phi, a plus 2 phi, 1 over c squared, dr dt squared, pi over c squared. So that's a term that's there, and it's going to be important if we're moving very quickly. But what I'm saying is, so what I wanted to match onto was when this was small, and so I'm going to throw that term away. Okay.
Another question. So again, I think you're making a good point, which I guess I skipped over. I'm just by fiat telling you, I mean, that's the way the book goes. I'm just by fiat telling you that the simplest solution of Einstein's equations is this one right here. But at the same time, when I wrote down that line element, or when I wrote down this metric, you're absolutely right. I wrote it in a very specific set of coordinates. And so this is typically called the Schwarzschild coordinates. But you're absolutely right. Somebody else could have done the calculation and come up with a solution that looked different, but it would have been the same geometry if it had all the same, well, the claim is if it had all the same properties, namely it was spherically symmetric, static, asymptotically flat, and well, this would have just followed from physics, but if it had those other properties, then that space-time geometry, that solution would have been actually identical to the one that we write here, but just in a different coordinate system. And there are, depending on the problem, there are other interesting coordinates. And in fact, that'll be part of the discussion later on when we try and address this. We'll just look at the same geometry, but we'll pick other coordinate systems that make different features of the geometry more obvious or simpler. And I think in one of the problems, if you're working on it this weekend, you're invited to change the coordinate system to isotropic coordinates. So if you're interested, there's a problem at the end of the problem set where you explicitly change the radial coordinate and put this in a different form. Are there any other questions? Okay. So again, what we want to do is we want to probe this space-time geometry and look at how particles move, and so see how gravity works in general relativity. But before I do that, I want to I want to talk about an important lesson in being lazy. And so I'm going to talk about geometrized units. And it comes, well, the story is very similar to the story of C in special relativity. And there, when we had, well, in typical calculations, when you had a time component, there was always a C or a 1 over C. And basically what C was doing is it was giving us a conversion constant to take us between time units like seconds and distance units like meters. So C was just a conversion constant, or can be regarded as a conversion constant between standard time and length units. But what we do, or what the book suggests we should do, is to make our life simpler, and so that when we do our calculations, we have less stuff to carry around. We just set C equals 1. Or alternatively, what we do is we measure time in length units. And so that just simplifies what I have to write down on the page. Now, similarly, if I look at the Schwarzschild metric, what you'll see is that there's this combination of things appearing in the metric. This is just, that combination is, again, just a number. And so what that means is that this combination G times M over C squared is something that has the units of length. Because it's when it's divided by when it's divided by R, it gives me just a number that I can stick there and subtract from 1. Or alternatively, we already saw that the gravitational potential over C squared was a dimensionless quantity. So similarly, in GR, find that the mass is always accompanied by a Newton's constant, and typically it's Newton's constant divided by C squared. So there, what we're doing is we're translating mass units, or standard mass units, say kilograms, to length units again. But we adopt the same strategy to simplify our formulas, to make life easier for us. What we're going to do is we're just going to say, well, let's imagine that we're going to measure masses in length units. And that's adopting then a convention where that conversion constant is just 1. Probably going too low. Yeah?
How do you get mass to length units if you're talking about length squared?
Sorry?
Well, you have C squared, so how does that give you length units for mass?
You know, what I have is the combination G, Newton's constant divided by C squared.
Never mind, sorry.
Okay. So again, I'm just going to choose units or that from an everyday point of view, that's a strange set of units. But what it does is it makes our formula simpler. And in particular, if we've adopted both of these conventions, then what people typically write is that individually we're setting Newton's constant 1, C1, and these are the so-called then geometrized units, because every single measuring is measured in units of length. So time is measured in units of length, mass is measured in units of length, length is measured in units of length. So that's just something to keep the bookkeeping simpler. And so, for example, I apologize, but it's here. What I can do is I can just erase all of the g's and all of the c-squares, and I would say this is Schwarzschild, or the Schwarzschild metric. And geometrized units. Is there any question about that? Okay. So what I wanted to start at least today was make headway in thinking about test particles moving around in our space-time, or to see how gravity affects the motion of particles in this geometry, space-time geometry.
So you now set G and C to 1.
What you do is you go back and you reinsert the G's and the C's. And in fact, I'll be doing that on Monday. I mean, one of the important things is that the reason you get away with this is, again, if an astronomer is doing some calculation or some set of observations, you know, and tells you that a certain star or a certain black hole has a mass, he's not going to tell you the mass in kilometers. But you can do this calculation, but then at the end of the day, you have to stick the G's and the C's back in there to convert to the appropriate set of units. But that's always a straightforward, or the claim is that it should be a straightforward thing to do. But in fact, yeah, to look at the Newtonian limit, I'm going to have to stick the G's and the C's back into the formulas for writing down. Let's look at
test particle motion or particle motion. We have our action from last day. And in this case, then, well, if we call this the Lagrangian, well, there's this factor of m, but I'll skip that. Then L tilde is then minus 1 minus 2m over r times dt d tau. So there's our action. We could go ahead and vary that and get the geodesic equations. But the first thing when we approach a problem like this that we should do is we should look for all the conserved quantities and all of the constraints that we can. And I already mentioned two of them. So, sorry?
When did we normalize from not that it happened?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, I'm not ready.
No, at this stage, it's a lambda in a couple minutes, it'll turn into a tau when we apply the constraint for the norm of the tangent vector. So we had two killing vectors, two obvious killing vectors.
The first one, I guess we called epsilon. Which then should give us a constant. If I plug things in, basically what that's doing is it's picking out, well, if I do that, I pick out GTT, UT. Because there's this factor of m, and I thought somebody was going to get upset and say the Lagrangian is the full integrand, not this bit here. And I also really want to write d tau, so let's skip ahead over here. One of the things we're going to do is we're going to have as a constraint. Well, okay, I'll do it down here. We know, or what we found, or what we discussed about, is that this combination is the norm of the tangent vector is actually a constraint, and that comes because this action or this L tilde or Lagrangian or whatever doesn't have any explicit lambdas in it. And so we're allowed to impose equals some constant. And in order that it be time-like, that should be a negative constant, or the norm squared of the tangent vector is negative. A convenient choice to make is to set it equal to -1, in which case I'm allowed to call lambda the proper time of our test particle or our observer. So if I did this first, then when I get over here, I'm allowed to call that lambda tau. And so there's some constant there, and what is it? It's going to give me -1 - 2m/r dt/d tau. And then the constant, it's just an integration constant that characterizes different geodesics, but it needs a name. And so a convenient name that's chosen here and in the book is to call it -e. And that minus sign is just to get rid of that minus sign over there. Okay. So what we can write is dt by d tau equals e over 1 minus 2m over r. To give some physical interpretation to what that constant is, what we can imagine doing is going out to r equals infinity, where that goes away. At r equals infinity, I was just doing physics in Minkowski space. And so what I would have for the particles moving around in that asymptotic region is dt by d tau is equal to e. Or alternatively, this is just the energy per unit mass, or it's the relativistic energy divided by mass. Again, we've set c equal to 1, and so I'm discarding factors of c squared. So that's just to give an interpretation to what this integration constant is. And we do it by going to a special place where we know how physics works, i.e. the place where there is no gravity. So that was the first. The second killing vector we call eta. And that was delta phi, no, delta alpha phi. And again, we have the rule that eta tilde dot u tilde is equal to a constant. That's now just g phi phi, d phi d tau equals a constant. And that is r squared sine squared theta d phi d tau. Again, this constant needs a name. And so the name that we adopt is lowercase l. And so we can write d phi d tau equals l over r squared sine squared theta. And again, well, I can go out to r equals infinity. I'm not going to throw anything away because there wasn't an m term or there wasn't a gravitational potential term here. But I can recognize then from thinking about this in the asymptotic region that this is a component of the angular momentum, or more appropriately, this is, or L has the interpretation of angular momentum per unit mass, or per unit mass of our test particle. So that's, again, by thinking about the asymptotic region where I'm infinitely far away and where gravity doesn't really change the geometry and it doesn't change the physics. It's just the physics of special relativity. Now, what that gives us then is, it gives us three first order constraints. So there's this one that tells us dt by d tau, d phi by d tau. And then there is a constraint hidden in this, which also only involves first derivatives. And so I've got three first order equations. Unfortunately, I have four variables. Namely, I have to solve for t, r, theta, and phi. And so I really have to break down and I have to look at the geodesic equation, at least for one of those components, or one of those variables. And so the simplest one to do is to look at so we need one more equation. So we look at the variation or the geodesic equation for theta. And again, rather than sitting down and calculating all of the components of the Christoffel symbol and then writing out what the theta component of the geodesic equation is, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to make a variation, delta theta, of the action, which unfortunately has disappeared. But hopefully we can remember that there's going, if I do that variation, I make the variation, well, what I get is d by d tau of the variation of L tilde theta dot is equal to that particular term. Over here, what I'm going to find is d by d tau. There's going to be a factor of 2 because there's a theta dot squared in one of the terms, and the coefficient there is r squared. So, and I'm being even, I'm adopting theta dot or dots for d by d tau. And then this term, well, unfortunately, there was a theta that appeared in g phi phi or in the coefficient of phi dot squared. And so here I find 2 sine theta cos theta times phi dot squared. There should be an r squared. Very good. Are there any other typos? But at this point, what we can do is we can look at this equation and recall what our discussion was for the central force motion. Basically, what I see is that, well, there are going to be lots of solutions to this equation. But if I make the special choice that theta is equal to pi over 2, then this side of the equation vanishes. And if I'm fixing theta equals pi over 2, I'm setting theta dot equals 0. And so a consistent solution But again, that is a typical solution because of our spherical symmetry. What this is saying is that there's a simple set of solutions that I know about, which are just moving around in the plane, theta equals pi over 2, or in the asymptotically flat region, that's the xy plane. But by spherical symmetry, no matter what orbit I have, I can always arrange the coordinate system or the theta phi directions so that the orbit starts at theta equals pi over 2 and theta dot is equal to 0. And then the equation says that it'll stay in the plane theta equals pi over 2. So that's a particular solution, but we're using the spherical symmetry to orient the coordinates. We can always set any orbit. Be in that particular plane. Or what we said before is that all of the orbits in the central force motion problem, all of the orbits were planar. So with that, then, I've reduced the problem down to solving for 3 things, or 3 variables. I'm going to solve for phi, t, and r. And so I'm running a little bit late, but I wanted to just, we have the equations for the theta, or for the t and the phi. I just wanted to write out what the equation is for the r. And that's just making explicit the constraint, u dot u is equal to 1. And so that is minus 1 is equal to minus 1 minus 2m over r dt by d tau squared plus r dot squared and so here what I've done is I've thrown away theta dot and I've set theta equals pi over 2 and so the sine theta just became 1 but I also have these nice formulas that tell me what t dot and phi dot are and so I can get rid of those expressions, and you end up with a minus e squared over 1 minus 2m over r here, plus r dot squared. And then that term I'm using now L over R squared, sine theta is again equal to 1. And so I end up with L squared over R squared. And so in principle, this is an equation where I can solve for R dot. It is a more complicated equation than these. And so what we do is we do this trick of massaging the equation to put it in a simple form. So with some algebra, what we do is we write this as on one side of the equation. Well, OK, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply by 1 minus 2m over r. Then I'm going to divide by 2. And I'm going to put the e squared over here with the constant 1. So I just have a constant on this side of the equation. The r dot squared then comes with a 1 half r dot squared. And then there's a bunch of other terms that are 1 half 1 minus 2m over r, 1 plus l squared over r squared minus 1. Ah, OK. So that's just massaging this and putting it in this form. And again, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to say, I'm going to do the same thing that I did in the example yesterday and say, well, gee, that looks like a problem that I know how to solve. It looks like one-dimensional classical motion in a potential. That is, it looks like a Hamiltonian constraint for some simple system. If I write the energy 1 half r dot squared v over r. So the analog problem that I have intuition about is this simple problem of a classical particle of unit mass moving around in some potential with a fixed energy. And so our effective energy is just this combination here of the e squared minus 1 over 2. And the effective potential is that stuff over there. And rather than writing all that stuff out over again, I'll just explicitly expand it out. And so if I do this multiplication, what I get is the first term goes like minus 1 over r. Then there's a term that goes like l squared over 2r squared. And then there's a term that's a cross term between those two. And so I find minus m l squared over r cubed. But if we stare at that just a little bit, what we might recognize is that it's a slight variation of the central force problem or the Newtonian gravity problem that we studied before. When we studied Newtonian gravity, we had this term. This is the effective potential. So we had our Newtonian potential m over r. Again, there were units that we discarded. And then there was this repulsive angular momentum barrier. And so there's one extra term in our potential. And so this, if you like, is a GR correction. T to the Newtonian problem. And so all of the new physics in at some level is coming from this one single term that we've added to this potential here. And it looks like I've run out of time to talk about that interesting new physics. And so we'll have to pick up there next day. However, given the intuition you have for this problem and the fact that it's just a classical mechanics problem, I've invited you on the problem set, which we'll get this afternoon, to play around with some of these equations and see what comes out. One comment, and I direct the question to our tutors. Do these guys have maple? Oh, dear. Okay.
If you've got one of the Linux laptops that we provided. So there should be people here that have Mathematica and can actually install it as well.
Try to install it, fine.
Okay, leave your hands up if you actually installed it and it works. Great, so this is how many people we have with Mathematica.
But it's better than that. We can SSH over to Proteus and use Maple there. It's slow to molasses, but it does work.
Yeah, but if 30 people log to Proteus and use Maple on that, it will just be...
Well, some of us log again tomorrow.
I hope you're pushing out installations to all your Linux laptops very soon. And then the idea is you can just type in some code. On the emails, do they have a code?
If once you run it, you put this into the window, then it'll take you to some other web page, or you have to allow to put in another number.
Then you register, and then they send you an email with the code that you write.
Right.
Good.
Long answer.
I didn't really want to invoke a discussion about Mathematica and Maple, but the comment was just that one of the problems I asked you to hand in.
At the end, the very last part, I'm asking you to show that this property, d phi by dt squared times the radius of the orbit cube, is equal to a constant for some set of orbits. Now, if you just naively write down, you've got lots of formulas, you just write them down, you'll get some expression like this, MREL, where these are these integration constants. I guess that's the radius of our orbit, and M is characterizing our geometry. And sure enough, yeah, that's a constant, but that's not really what I wanted you to show. What I want you to show is that, and I've labeled this function M for big mess, what I want you to show is that at the end of the day, this only depends on the M, or the constant that characterizes the space-time geometry, not the parameters that characterize the orbit. To do that, you're going to have to find a couple of equations. So for example, you might find some equations that eliminate these two integration constants. And then the miracle is going to be that if you find those equations to eliminate two, and there are only two equations, that the R is going to drop out. And so the comment was going to be that finding the two equations, and you may not want to eliminate those, you may want to eliminate this and that or some other combination, but finding the equations to eliminate some stuff is physics. Massaging it and getting it down to this is algebra. And it took me 15 minutes. And so I'm a little bit worried how long, given that I've done the problem already once, how long it might take you. And I was going to say that it's fair game. What I'm really interested is that you can think about the physics problem and come up with some equations. And I was going to say that it's fair game if you want to plug your equations and your mess equation into something like Maple and Mathematica to prove this, that's fair game. On the other hand, I'm not sure how easy that will be. And so, well, that was the only comment. I had hoped that you all had a Maple or a mathematical easily accessible. But if it doesn't work, you know, don't spend hours and hours and hours trying to do algebra. The main point was to think about the physics. And with that, I've gone way over already. And so unless there are any questions, I guess we'll take a break. Okay, so we'll see you on Monday.